Marty Two Bulls Jr. takes the helm of the Rapid City Arts Council. From SDPB, today is Thursday, May 1st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk with Two Bulls about leadership in the arts. From his time at the Sanford Underground Research Facility in Lead to the first time his work was displayed in a gallery at the Doll in Rapid City. We will hear from the artist a bit later in the hour. But first, the University of South Dakota Opera brings a Gilbert and Sullivan classic to the stage in Vermilion. We'll talk with cast members about why music in the state matters. That's coming up after the news. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The show must go on. The University of South Dakota Opera's presentation of Gilbert and Sullivan's The Gondoliers was canceled in 2020. You remember why. The production is happening this spring. In fact, it's this weekend at USD. That's May 3rd and 4th. We're going to get a preview now. Tracelyn Gesteland is professor of voice and opera at USD. She is the stage and music director for The Gondoliers. We also have two students with us. Abby Beckler is a graduate student in vocal performance and music history. Brian Shirley is a senior majoring in musical arts and marketing. They play major characters in the opera. All three sat down in SDPB's studio on the University of South Dakota's campus in Vermilion.
We do three productions a year, basically a touring program in the fall. We have a winter gala, and then we have our annual spring main stage production with orchestra. So we are really excited to be coming off of a major national award last year for our world premiere of Notes on Viardot. So it's a great time for opera at USD.
It's a great time for opera in South Dakota. We're just coming off of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra's Giants in the Earth, and they had a full house for that opera. But Tracelyn, I will tell you that some people, it was the first opera they'd ever seen, and I talked to some guests who were like, I liked it, but I wasn't sure what to think about opera. So let's talk a little bit before we talk about this production about inviting concertgoers, especially into opera for the first time. How do you sort of set the stage for people to have a good experience?
This is a perfect opera for people to come and see for the first time. There are so many different styles of opera, and I think too many times people get stuck on the style where it's the person standing with the horned hat and singing at you for 3 hours, but this is definitely not one of those. This is basically for people who perhaps love musical theater, because this opera is sort of representative of the bridge between grand opera into musical theater. Mm-hmm. So if you love Rodgers and Hammerstein, you will love Gilbert and Sullivan.
So what is opera?
Oh boy, how much time do you have?
I feel like that's where we need to start, because for some people, they have just never had any experience whatsoever.
That is a great question. It's lyric theater. It's drama set to music. So in opera, you tend to think about a larger scale, big orchestra, big sets, continuous singing through composed. And then as we get into Gilbert and Sullivan, we see dialogue being added, and we see a little bit more accessible music, so that you have an opening chorus and then a dialogue scene and then a duet, and it's not just wall-to-wall music.
How long of a history? How long has this been around?
That started around 1600, I would say, in Venice, and that's where this show is set.
All right. I feel like you really want to tell me about The Gondoliers, so let's let's talk about this particular show, The Gondoliers. What's it about?
So the story is about two charming Venetian gondoliers, Marco and Giuseppe, and they come to find out through mistaken identity that one of them is about to become the king of Barataria, but no one knows which one is the royal heir. Mm-hmm. And then the Duke and Duchess come in and announce that their daughter in infancy was promised to marry the future king of Barataria. And then complications arise when Marco and Giuseppe have been married to two other women. So we have three wives, two husbands, and no one knows who's the king.
All right. And Brian, you're one of those charming gondoliers. Tell me a little bit about Marco.
Yeah, absolutely. So Marco is one of the two gondoliers, of course, one of which is the son of Battisto Palmieri. And the whole show is kind of this crisis of identity of who is which. We are both rooting for each other, but we're also both rooting for ourselves. and there's this great build and excitement in finding out who's going to be king. So Marco's progression through the story starts off as this, you know, easygoing, lighthearted, and a little bit dense character, a bit of a ladies' man as well.
Okay.
And our endeavors of finding a wife, and then the transition to royalty, which perhaps Marco and Giuseppe are not the most experienced with, and their idea of royalty is a little more relaxed than maybe others.
And Abby, somebody has to be queen, but nobody knows whose is going to be. Tell me a little bit about Casilda.
Yeah, so Casilda is the daughter of a Duke and Duchess of Spain, and so she's used to kind of the high life and being a noble woman. Mm-hmm. So she knows that she's married to one of two gondoliers, but doesn't know which. And to complicate matters further, she is secretly in love with her father's sort of royal attendant, Luis. And so she is just passionately in love with this third man, and knowing that she can never be with him, and is married to somebody, she's not sure which, and they're both a little bit confused gondoliers who don't really know how to be a king, and so she's going through it.
Yeah, everybody. And Dr. Gestelin, this is just the classic, you know, it's Shakespearean, it's Greek, it's Gilbert and Sullivan, it is the hero's journey. It's a great story. Tell me a little bit about Gilbert and Sullivan and what kind of stories they were interested in bringing to the stage.
They were really interested in doing comedy, but with a satirical slant involved. And so this one sort of wraps in satire of the monarchy and of class and wealth. Mm-hmm. It's all done in a lighthearted way, wrapped into just really singable melodic tunes and rhythmic fun.
Did you pick this particular production for a reason? Was it based on students that you had with you, or is it just based on the production itself that you wanted to try?
First and foremost is always trying to feature the student talent that we have. And actually, I had chosen this in 2020. And we had gotten all the way up through learning all of the music and memory checks. And then everything was canceled because of the pandemic.
Ah.
And so I put it on the shelf and thought, well, I guess that's that. But it's just such a fun show. And I hoped that at some point we'd be able to do it. And so last summer when I was programming for this year, I thought, what are we going to follow up this world premiere with?
Yeah.
It has to be something really fun and splashy and engaging. And so it fit the bill for that reason. And also, it's a very large cast, and we get to feature a lot of our student talent.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about those students and the programs that they're going through. Are most of them going to go on to careers in music? Is it something that they're going on? Are most of them double majors? What kind of students do you see in the program at USD?
Most of them are music majors right now, the majority of them being music education, but we do have some performance majors, some musical arts majors, some music tech majors, and then, of course, in our orchestra pit, we have our instrumentalists as well.
Right,
so it's a wide variety, mostly undergraduate with a handful of graduate students.
Yeah. Brian, what's musical arts? Tell me about that program.
Sure. Musical arts is kind of a broader scope of a music degree. If you go music performance or music education, it's a little more straightforward and clear-cut of a path that you're going to follow. If you're going into music performance, of course, you intend to perform. And education, of course, you're taking up a career in education. Musical arts is for someone who wants a broader education in the field of music, but perhaps isn't actively pursuing a performance or education career.
Yeah. Where's your hometown?
Rapid City.
Oh, okay. So what are you hoping to do next? You're a senior. Tell me a little bit, first of all, about this kind of performance at the end of your undergraduate, and then also how you take that forward.
Sure. I mean, this last performance, there's a lot of emotions involved. The growth I've undergone through this program has been just tremendous, and I've accumulated a lot of skills that I think I can apply to tons of places in the real world. What's next for me is I'm going to be spending some time at Mid-Bell Music in Sioux City as a marketing specialist, using both my majors. It still keeps the door open for any sort of performance, which is why I wanted to keep music around anyway. If, for example, I want to perform as a soloist, or if I want to take up another opera, if I have some extra time, it really leaves the door open for me to still keep exploring the musical side of things.
Abby, tell me a little bit about vocal performance and music history, why you wanted to study that, and you're a graduate student. So what kind of program are you in?
Yes, so I am, as you said, double majoring in vocal performance and music history. My bachelor's degree is also in vocal performance. So the vocal performance route is at USD a little bit, it's more operatic, classical voice focused. Mm-hmm. I study classical voice, I'm a soprano, and combining the two has been really great over these last couple of years because my goal as I move forward is to teach in higher education.
What's your hometown?
Orange City, Iowa.
Oh, nice, nice. Mm-hmm. Dr. Gesteland, tell me a little bit about, because we're spending the whole hour talking about the arts and living as an artist. And there's, you know, an intensity to the study that these students will have to do, especially to be able to take the stage in roles like this. But it's also, you know, singing and music is part of so many people's lives. How are you helping prepare students to not only find jobs and the work, but also to live creatively? Do you think about that much in the program that you put together here?
Absolutely. Yes, we try to meet students where they are and then help them to achieve all of their individual goals. It's pretty hard to do that because everybody has such a different goal. But I would say the overall gist of things is we're trying to promote healthy vocal technique and an understanding of the voice so that they can take that and use that for a lifetime in whatever style they end up choosing ultimately to perform. I think instilling a good work ethic is something we aim to do with everyone, and teach them to be total musicians so that it's not just about having a pretty voice, but they're also learning about how to interpret the music, how to interpret poetry. We do repertoire study guides so that they all really understand the nuts and bolts of their music and the poetry. And so hopefully all of those things help provide a good foundation.
We had a really fascinating thing on Science Friday last week where they had death metal singers, and they put them in an MRI to look at their vocal folds to see what was happening when they were making these sounds that are really iconic death metal sounds. Mm-hmm. And then using that to not only help those musicians, but to help people with vocal injuries. You know, for example, would you mention healthy vocal technique? So opera, should we put Abby and Brian through for the MRI? Like, let's talk a little bit about healthy use of your voice, because there's some real technique. And you mentioned, you know, Brian, the emotions that are involved with just the performance. You have to be able to be on stage, do the acting, do the singing, get through humor, pathos, all these things, and still sound good. You have to have control of your vocal performance. Tell me a little bit about technique and preparation for that kind of complex stage performance.
Well, we talk about the singers as being vocal athletes. Mm. So it's all about building up stamina. You know, no one just jumps into a two-hour opera without a lot of training, just like an athlete wouldn't just run a marathon out of the blue, right? So it's in the daily practice. It's in the hydration. It's in the diet. It's in the conditioning, all of that stuff, and then making sure that you're using correct breath support so that you're not putting undue stress on the vocal folds, and we're just trying to find the most ultimate vocal production with as much ease as possible.
Abby, what would you add to that? What have you learned about technique that maybe surprised you or would surprise people new to the field?
Ooh. So much over these last couple of years. I have learned so much pedagogically and as far as technique goes. Something that surprised me and kind of a way that I have reframed my study of the voice under Dr. Gesselind is the way in which diction and how we pronounce words on stage, and also the way we emote when we sing, how they are so intertwined. Mm-hmm. And I think vocal production and efficiency and all of that technique, diction and emotion and being able to express the music in your body and in your voice is often going to produce good technique, I think.
So give me a tip as a radio host that does not sing, but if there is a very emotional conversation and I'm trying to keep talking but not cry, what should I be doing with my body?
I think first and foremost is making sure that you're trying to keep your throat muscles relaxed and making sure that you're continuing to use enough breath energy so that your throat muscles don't tighten, and basically that'll affect your tone quality and your ability to project.
Okay.
So trying to maintain an open throat, keeping those muscles relaxed, trying to feed air through it, trying to keep your voice in a appropriate range so that you're not too low or you're getting too high, but just trying to keep everything in the middle.
Brian, what would you add? Other tips for performance that you've learned that maybe all of us could use? You're in marketing. Anybody who's giving a presentation in front of the board of directors, what are some of the things that you're going to bring into those experiences that might be useful for others?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot to be said of things that change when nerves get involved. If you get up in front of a large group of people, it is just a habit that most people would have to tense up or to speak more energized, more loudly, higher. And you just have to be so mindful of things that add tension to your body, because tension in your body, even if it's not your voice, will translate to your voice. If you're keeping your arms locked, your neck's gonna tighten up as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also with performing specifically, it is just such a balancing act of when to use your voice to its fullest and when to pull back a bit. You know, with how emotional performing can be, even when it's just in rehearsal, I'm sure all of the performers would love to sing 100% every rehearsal, but you can't. If you were going to the gym and lifting as heavy as you could every day, and at the end of the week you tried to set a personal best, you'd never get it. You have to be conscientious of what you're leading up to, knowing when to save that emotion and knowing when to let it all out.
That's a very good tip. Very good tips, you guys. Professor, give us some tips on how to get tickets to the show. Who's invited and where do we go to be in the audience?
Everyone is invited, and it's easy to get tickets. You can go to link.usd.edu/opera. to get your tickets in advance, which we highly recommend. Otherwise, you are also welcome to purchase them at the door 1 hour before curtain. And if you choose that route, then it's cash or check only.
Yeah. All right. Do I need to prepare for the opera? Do I need to understand the plot, look something up online? Or do you just go in? Is it in English, first of all?
It's in English. There are splashes of Italian, as it's set in Venice, but we have surtitles, so you'll be able to read any translations that you would need. You certainly don't have to prepare anything. This is just a fun day. Come on out.
You
don't have to dress up or anything. Just come as you are.
Anybody else you want to shout out about costuming or staging? Because there are a whole team of people other than the performers who are playing roles. What's behind the scenes?
Yes, opera takes a village. So we're very fortunate. We have our costumes coming in from Harlequin Costumes from Winnipeg, Canada, and our local costumer is Rachel Landis. So she's right now doing the final alterations, and we just had our fittings, and we're having our dress rehearsal tonight. And then we have Brian Adams is one of our local folks who's working on our set and sound.
Top notch, Brian Adams.
Isn't he?
Yes.
We are so lucky. And Jonathan Allender-Zivic is our lighting designer.
Nice. Wonderful. Well, I'm excited for you all. I'm excited for everyone who gets to be in the audience. Thank you so much for spending so much time, and I'm going to apply your tips to my work as a radio host as well.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
No one will ask me to sing. That's
you never know.
Little sneak peek there of The Gondoliers performed by USD Opera. You heard the voices of director Tracelyn Gesteland and actors Abby Beckler and Brian Shirley. Gilbert and Sullivan's The Gondoliers is this weekend at USD. That's May 3rd and 4th. We are going to put some links up on our website where you can learn more.
You are listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Last week, artist and educator Marty Two Bulls Jr. was named the interim executive director of the Rapid City Arts Council. He's an enrolled member of the Oglala Sioux Tribe and was the Symford Underground Research Facilities 2024 Artist in Residence. As interim director, Two Bulls is in charge of the Rapid City Arts Council's programming, community events, and efforts to support local artists. His appointment comes at an uncertain time for artists and arts organizations.
This is an announcement a lot of people on social media are pretty excited for. So let's talk first about what exactly it means. Your interim director, how long is that intended to last?
You know, it's a little uncertain. Okay. It's intended to last as long as it takes us to find a new executive director for the Rapid City Arts Council.
How will you be part of that search? Or are you supposed to be like keeping the shop running and doing the things and stepping in to keep things operational? Or are you also part of trying to decide the direction of the organization in the future?
Kind of all of the above.
Okay.
I've been serving on the board for the Rapid City Arts Council for almost 2 years now. And when our previous executive director left, I was a part of the search and screen team for the board, so interviewing applicants and trying to help find the right fit. And unfortunately, it's taken a little longer than we thought to find the right person. And so in the meantime, I have a lot of, you know, parallel experience in my, you know, professional background as an artist, an educator, an arts administrator, curator. So I kind of offered to step in to help guide the organization through this transitional period. After we find the ED, I'll still be back on the board and a part of the organization.
Yeah, you care about the organization deeply.
I do, yes.
Yeah. When did you start stepping into, you've been artist laureate for the Oglala Sioux Tribe. You were the artist in residence at SURF, the Underground Research Lab, in 2024. I want to let direct listeners to your March 26th interview with Lee Strubinger, which talked about smudging the Underground Research Lab. Really super interesting to listen to. But I'm curious, when did you go from artist to art advocate in the community space or in the leadership space? What was that transition like for you?
You know, I can't think of a particular moment. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of those things. As I've grown older, as I've, picked up more responsibilities, it just sort of felt like the right thing to do. I'm always kind of mentioning how it's strange feeling like an adult and being the one that has to do the hard things or the complicated things for the community. And it's a responsibility that I take seriously as a parent, as a community member, really trying to be of service and build a better community for everybody.
Many artists are afraid that if they step into those roles, that they will have to leave their artistic self behind, whether that means their personal work or just their way of seeing the world. Is it different for you, or do you struggle with that too?
There's always the issue of time, right? Mm-hmm. There's only so many hours in the day, and I'm a parent, and I have a personal life, and I'm always having to juggle my time to meet my studio practice. But I think for me, I don't think of my art practice in that way. Like, sometimes I'm making objects, and that that's where my creativity is. Sometimes I'm organizing exhibitions with different artists, and that's another place for my creativity. And in this new role that I'm in right now, you know, it's definitely a creative process, and, you know, maybe a little different than painting, but I'm still engaging in those kind of creative problem-solving ways. So I don't know. I mean, I let my art speak for itself, and I go from there.
What are some of the things that you love about this organization, its strengths going forward?
So I grew up in Rapid City, South Dakota. I grew up going to the Doll as a little boy. Mm-hmm. Some of my first public art exhibitions were at the Doll. And throughout my career, as I moved away and went other places, I would still come back and show work periodically there. I've always loved having that opportunity as an artist to be able to share my work in an established institution like that. I'm passionate about the education. We provide classes for youth and adults. You know, I still actively participate in the classes. Even as ED, I'm still doing the life drawing classes and things like that. Yeah. You know, I just think the arts are so important for our community and for the future.
How old were you when you first had work at the Doll?
I can't remember my exact age. I must have been in elementary school, so
really?
Around 10. They had a fundraiser where they'd commissioned artists to build mini golf, like, attractions.
Okay.
So, like, little mini golf things. And my dad and I made one together, and it was a prairie dog town which you could play mini golf around. And
nice.
I just remember thinking that was so cool, like making something and then having it be in a public space and have people come and appreciate it and talk about it and engage with it. And those are memories that have stuck with me my whole career.
Was it interactive?
It was, yeah.
It was.
Yeah, if I remember right, you paid like a little fee, a donation to the organization, and then you got to play the different like putt-putt golf or mini golf.
Each hole has a different, So very early on, you're in the studio and your kids have sat by you in the studio and you teach students and it's very hands-on. Many people have the opposite experience with art, that they go to a gallery, they see Monet, don't touch, don't breathe on it, it's for someone else. Your experience has been very, very different, including really interactive art that you saw people enjoy and had a playful nature to it, as well as impact. I find that interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, I think a lot of that too, you know, I have what you would say like a traditional Western art background or training. You know, I have an MFA from Bard College and a bachelor's in fine arts from Institute of American Indian Arts. And I have that in my background, but I also come from a Lakota background, which shapes my perceptions or ideas around art. You know, it's not always Monet's, priceless Monet's in the museum. Creativity and art is all around us and is a part of our lives, or our daily lives. And, you know, it's more of the way that I think of things these days.
At the same time, I think we all want to make it in some ways. Was there a time that you thought, you know, your art was maybe not when you were in 10, but you had something on exhibit at a gallery or in a, you know, you won a prize or something where you thought, yeah, people acknowledge that this is more than a hobby for me. I've put something into it and people have reflected and said, yes. Have you had those kinds of experiences, or is that outside of your, is that a very Western way of looking at it? Like, give me the blue ribbon?
No, I mean, it's a part of that. It's a part of the conversation, and it's something that I think about a lot. And I struggle with as a Lakota person, you know, we're a major value for our people is, you know, being humble and, you know, being a humble person and not, you know, letting your ego get carried away. But in the art world, you can't help but engage with the ego, you know, acknowledgments and sales and things like that. And I've certainly had national acknowledgments. I think one of the biggest ones in my professional career outside of this area is I was a United States Artist Fellow in 2022, which is a major national acknowledgement.
A big deal, yeah.
And, you know, certainly being acknowledged by my people, by my tribal community as being chosen as one of our artist laureates was a real humbling and great honor for me, and one that I take seriously. And that's part of this service, is thinking about the community. You know, certainly I would rather be in my studio making stuff, you know, traveling and going to shows. But, you know, the Rapid City Arts Council and the Dahl Arts Center are important places for not just me and my family, but the rest of the community. And I really want to see the Dahl continue to be that place and to help it grow and evolve as our community grows and evolves. And
yeah. What are some of those opportunities and even challenges that are facing an arts organization like this right now?
I mean, it's always funding.
Yeah.
You know, the Arts Reps, the Arts Council is a 501c3. It's a nonprofit. As far as nonprofits go, arts nonprofits are tricky to fundraise for. It's definitely different than healthcare or social work.
Yeah.
That funding's a little trickier to come by, especially at a time when, you know, there's a lot of national cuts happening to humanities and the National Endowment of the Arts. That all has ripple effects throughout the rest of the philanthropic arts world, so to speak. So yeah, I mean it's always money, but
yeah, right, it's
I'm used
money.
To that as an artist.
and one of the things that I think I see happening often is that when people try to articulate why the arts are important, it's tempting to fall into the most extreme examples, you know, suicide prevention or incarceration or things that are really us at our fringes. And it can be harder to explain to people why the arts matter for every third grader or for every one of us as adults. Is that because people don't engage in the arts themselves or that they don't acknowledge their own engagement in the arts? What do you think is happening there where it can be hard to communicate with people the value of the arts and why it should be funded unless you have a very, very specific reason?
I mean, a lot of it has to do with perception. When we talk about art, oftentimes I think people go back to that reference, you know, you made with the Monet or the Matisse.
Yeah.
You know, they think of art being framed on the wall in a fancy gallery or museum, and that can feel alienating to most people. I think, you know, as an educator, this was and something I would talk a lot about with my students is, you know, how we live with art. Like, look around your environment and where are you making decisions about your lived environment, your aesthetics. For some folks, that's family photos on the wall or a piece of art, maybe a print from Walmart.
Yeah.
What's on the fridge or
right.
What are the decisions you're making about your clothes? You know, these are all aesthetic decisions. For most arts organizations, you know, that's one of the struggles is getting people to see art beyond kind of these austere environments and making it more accessible and saying, no, actually, this is for you. You know, these exhibitions are for you. You don't need to have a master's in art history to understand this. Like, this is an experience that's intended to bring you in and hopefully evoke some kind of emotion or reaction or give you space to think about your life or your, you know, your past or your future, enrich in that way.
I don't know what life is like in Rapid City today, but here in Sioux Falls, the blossoms are just starting to open on the trees. So like half the trees will be open and half won't. And at my lunch break, I went and took some pictures at Falls Park of some beautiful bright pink blossoms. And, you know, that's art, even though I'm not really a photographer. We're engaging with this in so many different ways. It made my day so much better. Are there ways in your life where you're just pausing to do art that makes sense to you throughout the day, or is it largely appointment-based studio work?
No, certainly. I mean, if you look at my body of work, it's, you know, there's a lot of complicated processes. I get caught up in like ceramics or these larger scale installations or coordinating events like that Azealia project with Surf. But the thing I'm always doing all the time is just drawing. I have a really kind of compulsive habit of drawing, and even when I was a kid in school, I couldn't listen to the teacher without doodling.
Yep.
And I did my best listening when I was doodling. I'm always carrying a sketchbook, and you know, sometimes I'm doodling or drawing about a project that might turn into a big installation in some faraway museum, or it might be about the project, you know, the work I need to do it on my deck at home. You know, for me, drawing is a big part of my daily art rituals and life.
Are there themes you come back to again and again and again?
Certainly. And it's something I've only become kind of more aware of the older I've gotten and the more work that I have produced over the years,
yeah.
themes especially around history, thinking about kind of contemporary life, especially contemporary Lakota life. You know, my work has been engaged a lot with, you know, how we live today, not necessarily how our ancestors lived 100 years ago, but more about kind of our current kind of contemporary life.
The Azalea Project, now that it's, that you've had the experience, what's the value of communicating that experience to people going forward? So, like, you've made the art in this case. I guess I don't know if you consider it making art, but like the event, the moment, the real moment of physical space has happened. And now, what happens next with that? Is that, do you move on? Or are there more ways that you want to interact with that story?
That is the next big step for the Azalea Project, is sharing that and kind of communicating what that was about. Because it was two things. It was a performance, or in some ways a ceremony. And then, you know, on the other side, there was this documentation aspect. And the performance was kind of closed, was limited to certain folks. And some of that was for practical reasons. It happened in essentially what is an active construction site.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was one part, but the documentation was something that I'd really thought a lot about before I went through with it.
Okay.
Thinking about the power that sharing something like that can have and the impacts that it can have. And I'm still working out exactly how that's going to look. I mean, essentially it has to be a film project or an installation of some sorts. There's a prototype of something I'm thinking about right now in my current installation at the School of Mines and Technology.
Mm-hmm.
They have a gallery there called the Apex Gallery, and the exhibition from my surf residency is there, Ian Wanka, which translates to Holy Rock.
Okay.
And in that exhibition, I've included parts of the Azalea Project and video from the actual smudging of the mine shaft and elements from the performance, like the stove that I used to burn all the sage that I'd collected is there. And you can smell it in the room when you come in. That stove is just going to forever smell like sage. But I'm still working through that. And some of these things, cultural practices, aren't intended to be recorded or documented. Some are a little more open for sharing, and
yeah.
Really felt like it was important to do that with this.
There's lots happening in there, and I love how in a social media world too, you also created a space where you had to be present. Somebody's present. We're not all present at all times, and you're making artistic selections about what you show to whom and when, and that shows an intentionality that I think is really remarkable. And I can't imagine anybody who goes down into that space in the future will ever go down the same way again if they've had an interaction with your performance / project or residency. That's pretty powerful.
That was my hope, you know. That's what I'm hoping for.
That's a big deal. You're not going to say it because of the whole humility thing. I am not bound by this. I can just sit and say that is pretty monumental of an artistic achievement. Well done, sir.
Thank you.
That's artist Marty Tubbles Jr. He is the new interim executive director of the Rapid City Arts Council. If you would like to be the new executive director of the Rapid City Arts Council, Tubbles says they are looking for someone with experience in and passion for the arts. You can learn more about the organization and its events and programs. Go to Dahl Art Center's website. It's thedahl.org. Dahl, by the way, is spelled D-A-H-L. Stories on In the Moment that are multifaceted, complex, deeply personal, and real. Think about this. How often do you stop in your tracks or in your driveway and think about what you're hearing? The human ear is naturally drawn to somebody talking about something they care about. And you hear what people care about on SDPB. Please make your affordable gift to ensure we can keep doing this. SDPB.org/donate or call 605-443-6963. I'm Lori Walsh, the host of In the Moment, and with me in the studio today, Molly Bruin.
Yes, and I need to be real for a second. Threats to federal cuts to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting are serious and very real. SDPB receives about 20% of our annual budget from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and a cut of this size would drastically change the news, stories, and conversations you hear on SDPB. And you can do something about it. You can support public media and SDPB right now with your gift at sdpb.org/donate or call 605-443-6963. And with your gift right now, you're joining the national movement of fellow public media nerds supporting the news, stories, and conversations that matter to them with a financial gift during public media giving days.
Please protect public media. Our editorially independent work can continue when we have your help. There is a lot of noise out there. I'll say that again. There is a lot of noise out there. But here on SDPB, you find quality news, conversations, and storytelling that touch your heart. We tell stories that are impactful, not necessarily profitable. And there are stories from South Dakota that need to be told. Support more stories like these when you give right now, sdpb.org/donate, 605-443-6963. And thank you for supporting public media in South Dakota.
SDPB provides time for you to understand the truth, see what life is like for others. There are new challenges before us, but with your help, SDPB can continue to expand our reach to serve you in a bigger and better way. Give right now and support Lori's next conversation at sdpb.org/donate or call 605-443-6963.
All we're asking is that you give what works for you. Whether that's monthly or a one-time gift, your donation helps SDPB face uncertainty. Your support is the backbone to SDPB's editorial independence, unique storytelling, and thoughtful shows. Support more shows like In the Moment with your gift, any amount, right now, sdpb.org/donate, 605-443-6963.
And when you support SDPB, you're protecting open conversations. You're protecting storytelling that's delicate, hefty, alluring, and always real. What we provide, the stories Lori has, are essential to a healthy community. Please do your part. Give at sdpb.org/donate or call 605-443-6963 and help SDPB remain strong during times of financial uncertainty.
And it is times like these that we can really lean in to what SDPB represents in our community. Authentic storytelling, trusted news, insights into what it means to live right here in South Dakota. Yes, there are some strong headwinds that are going to challenge everything SDPB is and has. Your gift right now will help us face that uncertainty from a place of strength. Please protect what SDPB means to your life and your community. 605-443-6963, sdpb.org/donate.
Thank you for your donation. We know how uncertain times are right now for all of us. We're grateful for your kindness and generosity as you support this nonprofit organization that benefits our entire state. Make your voice heard and support public media across the nation with your gift to SDPB today. Donate right now. Call 605-443-6963 or go to sdpb.org/donate.
Now, before we close out even this hour, you can check one thing off your to-do list. Make that donation to SDPB. Make sure public media has a place in South Dakota for future generations with your gift right now. We cover stories that impact our entire state, from Beersford to Spearfish, from Black Hawk to Wentworth, and we need to keep it that way. Your donation helps SDPB continue the exceptional news, conversations, and stories you hear on SDPB and on In the Moment. Make an affordable but really impactful gift, sdpb.org/donate, or call 605-443-6963. And thank you.